Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Coming up later in the program, a new report says nursing homes still don't have enough PPE, and a new book about one woman's breast cancer journey. But up front, tomorrow is Election Day, and most years we could safely say the long presidential campaign will be over. Not this year. As of right now in Pennsylvania, mail-in ballots can be counted up to 3 days past Election Day if they are postmarked by November 3rd. The latest Franklin and Marshall College poll indicates most Pennsylvanians will vote in person tomorrow, even though more than 3 million requested mail-in ballots. Lawyers are gearing up for legal challenges. There still are many questions surrounding the 2020 election and voting. WITF's Emily Previty has reported extensively on the election and voting and is here to answer questions that you may have. Emily, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Scott.
If you have a question, maybe a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalk. WITF. Phone number, once again, 1-800-729-7532. Emily, we've already received some questions from listeners. Try to answer these questions, I don't know if I'd say last minute, but at least the day before election.
Okay.
Some of the questions we've actually received, a version of this question from several people. It was prompted by an article in The Atlantic saying the Republican-controlled legislature could choose electors if there isn't a clear-cut winner. Explain how that would work and the chances that that could happen.
So basically, if that's the situation and we're getting close to December 8th, which is Safe Harbor Day and the deadline for states to resolve election disputes and determine electors, then the state Senate Majority Leader Jake Corman told The Atlantic that the legislature would appoint electors. In his view, he said there would be no choice. He also, said that he hoped a clean vote count would produce a final tally on election night, which is not going to happen. There's never been a final tally on election night because, final results are not certified until days or even, a week or so thereafter. Under normal circumstances in the past, as with this year, provisional ballots that are cast during in-person voting have to be counted. And when absentee ballots were only being used by a minuscule percentage of voters in Pennsylvania, 5% or fewer, as they had been for years until 2020, counties also didn't process those ballots until after Election Day. And some counties, even this year, as we'll discuss in further detail, are not going to even start until Wednesday this time around. So all of that being said, after the Atlantic story ran, Corman went onto Twitter and tweeted that all of it was conjecture and Pennsylvania Republicans aren't going to do it. And the state Republican Party released a statement saying the same thing. We really won't know until this all plays out, but I should note that the Pennsylvania House tried to create a panel by resolution which would not have been subject to a gubernatorial veto, and that would have been majority appointed the panel and dominated by Republicans and have subpoena power to investigate election procedure during November, basically, and deadline of November 30th to finish its work. But after backlash over that proposal from Democrats and the public, they backed off. The concern was that the panel would be used to disrupt counting ballots. And after, like I said, the Democratic backlash, the backlash from the public, they backed off. So that seems to suggest they're not operating in a vacuum and immune from public opinion, public outrage. So That indicates perhaps that, they're not just going to plow ahead with doing whatever they may want in that situation.
So just kind of the civics lesson here is that it actually is electors who elect the president or, vote for the president from a state. So that December 8th date is an important one.
Correct.
But, I mean, I know that we all are hoping that by the end of this week, there is a winner here in Pennsylvania as determined by voters. Let's take a phone call from Bobette in Lancaster. Bobette, you're on the phone. Oh, you're on the air.
Hi. My question is, but maybe I'm wrong, but places like maybe Cumberland Valley, that they're not even going to start counting the mail-in ballots until Wednesday, the day after election. And it worries me because it's going to maybe seem like the vote is going one way and all these votes haven't even been counted yet. And, you know, like, I know that you have President Trump saying things like, well, I think that we should be counting all the votes on the first day, or, you know, on Tuesday. I don't know. It just worries me that they're not going to be counted. And I don't think Cumberland Valley is the only place.
No, they're not. Hey, Bobette, thank you very much for your question. Emily, this is a story that just kind of came out late last week, and Cumberland County is not the only county that said that they won't start counting mail-in ballots until Wednesday. A lot of it has to do with staff, but talk about that a little bit and what the thinking behind that is and what happens as far as slowing down the vote.
So Cumberland is the largest county, the county with the highest number of registered voters that I'm aware of that's going to wait until Wednesday morning. A handful of, you know, some of the counties that have a smaller number of registered voters, like Greene, Fayette, Franklin, Juniata, Mercer, Beaver, Forest counties, they're all waiting until Wednesday morning, and the rest of them, the vast majority of counties, will start processing mail ballots when polls open or shortly thereafter tomorrow morning. So as to how much that will slow down the determination of the outcome of the presidential election, I'm not certain, but I think the thinking on the part of those counties that are waiting is that there will be larger counties still counting on Wednesday, and they can wrap up in a day. So that's sort of the thinking there.
You something you said, I just wanted to clarify, excuse me, that you said the counties will start processing at 7 a.m. tomorrow. Processing does not mean counting, correct?
Correct. There are, you know, with mailed-in ballots, there are two envelopes that have to be opened, which takes a while, particularly even if the county, which most of them do, have an envelope opener, envelope opening machine, it still takes a while. So they have to do that, extract the ballots and smooth them out and get them ready for scanning. So that's thousands and thousands of ballots that have to go through that process.
But the counting actually can't start legally here in Pennsylvania until after the polls close tomorrow night.
Correct.
At 8 p.m.
Correct.
Right. The U.S. Supreme Court said they may not decide whether mail-in ballots received after Tuesday will be counted. Give us a little bit of background there, and is there a chance that those ballots will not be counted?
So, yes, there is a chance, but generally courts try to avoid disenfranchising voters through no fault of their own. So in this case, Pennsylvania voters have been under the impression that their ballots will count if they get them back, if the ballots arrive by Friday, November 6th, and are post-March November 3rd or earlier. And those rules have been in place for about 6 weeks since the state Supreme Court decision in mid-September extending the ballot arrival deadline. We should note that state officials have been discouraging people to avoid mailing their ballots and instead hand deliver them before the election, or if they can't do that, to vote in person provisionally. But the states, basically, to answer your question, there is a chance, but it's not, I don't think, a very strong one, because, as I said, courts generally try to avoid disenfranchising voters if it would be through no fault of their own by following the rules that were in place at the time that they voted.
But at the same time, the Department of State is taking some precautions in case that the Supreme Court would rule that those ballots can't be counted. How are they doing that?
So the state has asked counties to separate ballots just in case and to hold off on processing them. And those two, that last part is key. Counties already need to separate ballots and document the chain of custody for all mail ballots so they know when they came in and from where or how, so mail or Dropbox or over the counter, and could retrieve them prior to processing if necessary based on that information. But the distinction here is to wait to process the ballots. So they're not really doing anything that differently, just they have to sort of set them aside and not process them.
And when you say set them aside, you're talking about the ones that come in after November 3rd.
After 8 o'clock, yeah, exactly.
Right. Okay, so here's a question from a listener, Andrew. It says, we keep hearing that ballots will be counted if they are postmarked by Election Day and received by November 3rd, but the postage-paid envelopes we received in Lancaster County, at least, don't get a postmark. Where does that leave us?
So that envelope is scanned, and there is a record, there's a digital record of it, you know, getting processed by the post office.
There is
also there's guidance. Also, there's guidance from, based on part of that state Supreme Court ruling that we referenced earlier, that if there's not a postmark, if unless there's like strong evidence that the ballot arrived, you know, that the ballot was not postmarked in time, that it should be counted. But again, those ballots are being set aside with the thinking that if they're not enough to make a difference in certain races, that should be established in the counting of the ballots that definitely arrived in time, you know, or by 8 o'clock on election night should be counted first.
Okay, here's another question from a listener. If someone requested a mail-in ballot but changed their mind and wants to vote in person tomorrow, what can they do?
Okay, so basically if you've requested it, change your mind, want to vote in person, if you have the ballot, take it to your polling place and surrender it, then vote in person. If you've already sent the ballot, you should go to your polling place and tell the poll workers the situation, at which point they'd instruct you on voting provisionally, which entails filling out an affidavit and casting a ballot that's different from the others.
Now, when you say surrender your ballot, surrender it to who?
To the poll workers.
To the poll workers, okay.
Right.
Let's see. William has a question. If a mail-in ballot is rejected, will the voter who submitted the ballot be notified?
No, they would not be notified.
So they would not know whether their ballot has been accepted or rejected?
That's what I've been told by the counties. A challenge is a different situation, but I should also note that counties, before rejecting a ballot, you know, outright or definitely rejecting it, throwing it away, they would contact a voter if there's an issue with the ballot that could cause it to be rejected. That's not state law, but most counties will attempt to contact the voter if there's a problem with their ballot to try to get it fixed, basically, rather than throw the ballot away.
A question from another listener. If I requested a mail-in ballot but have not received it, what are my options?
So basically, you could go to the polls and vote in person and just, you know, tell them what happened. It would be a similar situation to what we described before, as far as someone changing their mind. You also could go in person to your county election office today and tell them what happened and request that a new ballot be reissued, which you could then cast on the spot in hand and in person. But you'll probably end up waiting quite a while, given counties are not set up to be handling in-person ballot reissuances en masse. So that's an option, but it's not necessarily one that counties are encouraging people to use.
How do counties keep from How do you know? Because one of the things that there have been accusations of happening with fraud is that there would be voters who would be voting twice. How do counties keep that from happening?
So each mail ballot envelope has a barcode on it that's associated with that voter. So it's not on the ballot itself, because remember, the ballot that indicates how someone voted is inside of this envelope. So, you know, it's not linked to your detailed ballot that shows how you vote, just on the envelope containing it. And once that's scanned in, when it arrives, that, you know, indicates that the person has voted. So then if they go to the polls and vote, first of all, there's already a notation in the poll book that this person has requested a mail ballot. And so the poll worker would then say, okay, you've requested a mail ballot, and you're going to have to vote provisionally. So the provisional ballots are set aside and counted later. And what counties do is go through ballot by ballot and check that each provisional against their records to make sure that they're not counting a provisional ballot for someone who was also already voted by mail. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And Jeff sent us an email, and this is just to kind of complete something, one of your answers before, when we're talking about surrendering ballots. You said about bringing the envelopes in, and Jeff reminded us, and this is accurate, bring ballot and both envelopes to the polling place. In other words, everything that you received from, you should bring the whole thing. Let's see, what else do we have? With a completed mail-in ballot, can I drop it off at a polling place tomorrow?
No, you cannot. Most counties have a drop box set up near their main election office that will be accessible on election day. And for details on exactly when and where to access those drop boxes, you can go to votespa.com or your county's website. But you cannot drop off your ballot and vote it at your polling place.
Emily, if a voter is quarantined from the virus or sick tomorrow, is there a way for them to vote?
Yes. So Pennsylvania already has a process for requesting an emergency absentee ballot, which is the situation that you're describing. And there's a deadline of 5 o'clock on Election Day tomorrow to do so. The full details are on the Department of State website, again, votespa.com. in the mail-in and absentee ballot section. And that includes links to the necessary forms in English and in Spanish. And on the form that you'd have to fill out, there are common scenarios listed, such as illness or physical disability or work schedule, that prevented the voter from applying for a non-emergency absentee ballot or mail-in ballot before the deadline of October 27th, a week ago. You know, maybe you plan to vote in person, but since October 27th, got sick or were injured. And then there are a few lines where you can explain your situation if it isn't described by any of the scenarios that are listed on that document.
Well, Emily, we answered a lot of questions here. You answered a lot of questions here the day before Election Day. I want to thank you for being with us today and all the work you've done during this election season. Is there anything, any red flags going into tomorrow that voters should be aware of?
I would just say nothing really sticks out. There's a lot going on this year. Potential for irregularities and things like that. And just, I think, collectively, everyone's pretty apprehensive about how tomorrow is going to go. But I would just say the Department of State's website has a lot of information as far as procedure and things like that. And your county website, the vast majority of them are pretty comprehensive as well. So, you know, I wouldn't say that there are any major red flags ahead of tomorrow. I would just say people should definitely stay plugged in, stay informed. Department of State's Twitter is pretty good. You know, you have your trusted public media reporters and stations in your area, and you know, trusted local news sources as well, to stay up to date on how things are going.
Emily Previty, WITF reporter. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Scott.
Speaking of trusting news, with so much confusion and disinformation being bandied about ahead of the election, WITF's news director Tim Lambert will be joining us every Tuesday, including tomorrow, to answer your questions about finding information you can trust. Also be discussing how WITF will cover things like the voting process and what we'll be reporting on election night. You can send your questions ahead of time. Tim will be with us tomorrow, the last part of tomorrow's program. You can send your questions ahead of time to WITF.org. That's news at WITF.org. Let me say that again. News at WITF.org. Send it before tomorrow, and Tim and I will have a conversation tomorrow and try to answer your questions then. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar.
WITF's election coverage is supported by the law firm of Saul Ewing, Arnstein, and Lear.
A just-released study found that personal protective equipment, or PPE, is still low at many nursing homes and long-term care facilities, 8 months into the coronavirus pandemic. Now, that's significant because two-thirds of the COVID-19 deaths in Pennsylvania have occurred at these facilities. Joining us is PennPerg consumer advocate Emma Horst-Martz. Emma, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me back, Scott. Good to be here.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So, Emma Horst-Martz, what did the PennPerg study find about PPE at nursing homes and other long-term care facilities in Pennsylvania?
So across the entire country, there are about 15,000 nursing homes that report their data to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. And here in Pennsylvania, we have about 690 of those nursing homes. And we found that over the past 7 months of the pandemic, basically from the spring through the summer, there have been critical PPE shortages in many of these homes, both in Pennsylvania and across the country. And some of the worst shortages actually came with N95 masks, which we know are the most important things to keep people safe when they have to interact, especially indoors.
Okay, so let's, well, maybe we should define how you are defining PPE. What is the personal protection equipment that you looked into?
So PPE includes N95 masks, which are those masks that are the most protective, gowns that someone would wear over their clothing, eye protection, and surgical masks, which are, you know, the masks that people would normally use, like doctors would wear in hospitals. They're a little bit less protective than N95, but still pretty good.
So the N95 mask, you say that's where the biggest shortage has been. What did you find?
In Pennsylvania, about 17% of nursing homes did not have a one-week supply of these N95 masks. And having less than a week's worth of a certain item is considered a critical shortage because if there's a spike in that home, they could burn through the supply of masks within 1 to 2 days. And you don't always know when your next shipment is going to come in because the coordination has been so inconsistent across states and across the whole country.
See, you just raised a question in my mind. Where are these facilities getting their supplies? Where are they getting their PPE?
That's a good question. They're coming from a variety of different sources. We have a national stockpile, which there's supposed to be coordination between the federal government, state hospitals, local community governments, but that's really where the breakdown has happened over the entire pandemic. This really started in the spring, and then the supply actually improved over the summer and then dramatically, you know, worsened around July. So that's when we started seeing another spike. And we have reason to believe that the shortage is actually getting worse again as we get deeper into the fall and winter season.
Now, when you say we started to see another spike in the number of cases, and you have reason to believe that it's occurring now here in the fall, why do you have reason to believe that it is occurring now? Because of the spike?
Well, we work with a variety of organizations, including a group called Get Us PPE, which is actually run by health professionals across the country, and they are seeing another, critical shortage across a higher percent of nursing homes now that we're deeper into the fall season. So more nursing homes are, having severe shortages of masks and other critical supplies. So the federal data on this is usually about a month behind. So we'll know pretty soon and have another report out within the next month or so with updated data for the fall.
You mentioned N95 masks are more important, but you also have that there are nursing homes that do not have a 1 week supply of surgical masks. I'm not going to ask you to explain the intricate differences in the two, but we in the public have been told that a cloth mask would provide protection for other people. It's not the same in a nursing facility.
It is the same, although I will say that, the data doesn't show, we're not getting data about staff using cloth masks in nursing homes. It's really just N95 masks and those surgical masks. And that's what, provided by the national stockpile and between the state coordination. So there was about 13% of nursing homes in Pennsylvania didn't have a 1 week supply of surgical masks either. So that's also a big issue.
What about gowns and eye protection? What did the study find?
More than 15% of nursing homes in our state didn't have a 1 week supply of gowns, and about 14% did not have a week supply of eye protection. So, it's all between 10 and 20%, but if you think about how many people that could affect between the residents in nursing homes and the staff who work there and the staff's families who they're going home to, that's reason for concern.
And even though we're talking about percentages below 20%, which is 1 in 5, and with some of these it's closer to maybe 1 in 6, but still, that does not mean that a nursing home does not have a 1 week supply of one of these items, or maybe more than one, right? So you may have, though these percentages sound, that they're below 20%, when you look at, 17% don't have a 1 week supply of N95. There's another 15% that don't have a 1 week supply of gowns. They don't often overlap. So you could be talking large percentages of these facilities are missing at least one thing, right?
That's true. And the other part of our study analyzed data of nursing homes that were totally out of some kind of PPE. So some places, as you're saying, have a low supply of something, which could be dangerous if there's a spike in the home, a spike of cases. But a number of nursing homes across Pennsylvania also had run out entirely of different kinds. And again, N95 masks were the worst of that. So about 9% of nursing homes in the period that we looked at didn't have any N95 masks, which is a more serious problem.
What happens if a nursing home runs out completely? What do they do?
They might start using cloth masks. In other cases, they would just reuse the same mask for multiple days. And remember, ideally, you would change your PPE that you're wearing between the different patients or, residents that you're interacting with, so that you're not spreading germs potentially. That's the ideal scenario. But if, there's a shortage or a nursing home has run out of a certain supply, they might be reusing that, which could cause problems.
You know, one of the things that kind of raises eyebrows in a case like this is because, you know, here we are 8 months into this pandemic, and we haven't heard about a shortage of PPE equipment here recently. It's not been one of those issues that's been focused on. So I think that probably there are a lot of people who assume, okay, nursing homes, hospitals, they all have what they need. What you're telling us is they don't.
Exactly. You would think that we would prioritize protecting the most vulnerable people in our society. And we know that elderly people are more at risk of getting sick and passing away from the virus. So we really need to prioritize these communities. And some of the ways that we can better, you know, coordinate or supply nursing homes is, one, by fully enacting the Defense Production Act, which allows the federal government to provide more of these supplies across the whole country. Another way that states can handle this is by banding together and creating buying consortiums where they have more buying power to supply their own states rather than competing with each other. And fortunately, Governor Wolf did join a 7-state buying consortium in the Northeast. So Pennsylvania does have a little bit more buying power than states in another part of the country, for example.
So those are things that PennPerg is advocating. What about on the federal level? As you say, you know, a lot of these facilities are getting their PPE from federal stockpiles. We know that that was something that was inconsistent at first. It sounds as if it still is inconsistent. What does the federal government need to do?
So a big piece of this, like I said, is the Defense Production Act. That can increase production of PPE across the whole country. There's another bill that Congress could act on called the Medical Supply Transparency and Delivery Act. That was introduced by Congress this spring, and that would improve the supply chain so that it's more centralized and transparent. This would also keep prices stable because states, individual healthcare facilities, school systems, and businesses wouldn't be competing against each other for these supplies.
So, Lee, how did PennPerg get involved in this? What prompted the study?
So, as you know, we work to protect the public, and we often focus on consumer protection issues, making sure that consumers have a voice in the marketplace and in the laws that regulate the marketplace. So when COVID hit in March, this was a perfect storm of, you know, a huge healthcare crisis, which brought up even more issues for consumers. And this issue of, you know, lack of coordination, PPE, people are at risk in the places where they live and no fault of their own. This is sort of a combination of all of the issues that we work on normally and just become even more of a problem during the pandemic. So we thought, what is something that no one's focusing on, but it's a huge issue and we have the data to solve the problem?
Are there other areas in which you're looking into that are related to the pandemic?
Yes, there are a couple of different areas. We've also been advocating for improved testing coordination so that everyone who needs a test can get one. PPE, of course, is a big focus across all areas, not just nursing homes. We've also been advocating the entire time that communities and states should not, you know, reopen stores and all areas of daily life until it's really safe to do that. So at some points in the past year, we've actually called on states to shut down again, sort of get all their ducks in a row before reopening in a truly safe way. And the last area that I've been working on here in Pennsylvania is making sure that consumers don't lose access to their utility services if they can't pay during the pandemic.
Well, Emma Horst-Martz, who is a consumer advocate with PennPerg, I want to thank you very much for the information, sharing the results of this study. Thank you for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Lee Hurst is a breast cancer survivor who was diagnosed at the young age of 33. As the result of her experiences, she founded the Feel Your Boobies Foundation that seeks to make younger women aware of breast health. Lee Hurst has written about her and several other women's breast cancer experiences in a new book called Say Something Big, Stories About Little Lumps Inspiring Big Changes. Lee Hurst, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Hi, Scott.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So, Lee, your story. At age 33, you were diagnosed with breast cancer. Tell us how you found a lump and how you were finally diagnosed.
Well, I found the lump just through the course of daily routine. I wasn't really doing a self-breast exam or anything like that. I just noticed a change. And so I would go to my annual exams each year and wait to see if the doctors could feel it. And when they didn't, I pointed it out, just let them know that I felt something different. And I was sort of dismissed as nothing for a couple years. And then finally, at age 33, a nurse practitioner said I should probably get a mammogram just to make sure. And it did come back as stage 1 cancer. So I found it myself.
But you actually had to wait a couple years for a diagnosis. Why didn't the doctors, I don't want to say they didn't take it seriously, but why didn't they think it the lump was cancerous?
Well, I think it's very common with young women because, you know, you are at a lower risk of getting breast cancer. It's not super common. And I had no family history. So I think, you know, I'm not so sure that it was, you know, that they didn't take it seriously. I think it's just when you're in that group of women that aren't traditionally diagnosed, it can be harder to get the attention of a doctor. So, you know, luckily, finally, someone did think that it was better to just get it tested and find out, and you know, it did come back as breast cancer. So I always, you know, remind young women that you really do have to know your body, because when you're at that age where you're not getting mammograms, it really, you know, can be up to you primarily to bring it to the doctor's attention and push to get that testing.
What treatment did you receive, Lee?
So my surgery was a lumpectomy. The lump was small, and then I went on to do 4 rounds of chemo preventatively because I was so young, and I did 7 weeks of daily radiation, and then following that, I went on to do 5 years of a drug called tamoxifen, which just reduces your risk of recurrence.
You are cancer-free now. Congratulations on that. How long
Thank
have
you.
You been? How long have you been cancer-free?
It's been in April. It was 16 years. So, you know, I'm very happy about that.
Well, as I say, congratulations on that 16 great years. So you founded Feel Your Boobies Foundation. How did that come about?
Well, originally I just made some t-shirts while I was going through treatment. I would joke with my friends, say, you know, feel your boobies. You guys got to feel your boobs. That's how I found my lump. So I just, for fun, made some t-shirts over the summertime while I was in treatment. And I bought about 100 of them and put a one-page website up and shared it with my friends that I had scattered about the country. And it went viral. And so initially I just donated the money out to other breast cancer organizations. And over time, though, I realized that I actually had my own mission, that the Feel Your Boobies message was getting the attention of the younger population, and it was doing it in a more friendly way. And so once I realized that I had my own mission and my own ideas for how to reach that population of women, it turned into the foundation. And since then, we've basically, you know, educated young women simply by reminding them to feel their boobies. And the campaign generally uses media to reach out to that population of women. And, you know, we've had testimonials from women who say our campaign's the reason they found their lump. And they credit the campaign with their diagnosis. So very proud of the work we do. But it didn't start off as a plan. It was pretty much an accident that evolved into what's become my life's work, basically.
The book "Stay Something" or "Say Something Big," stories about little lumps inspiring big changes. What made you want to write the book?
Well, I have been asked throughout the years, you know, if I plan to write a book. I know that people have found my story inspiring about how much my breast cancer diagnosis changed my life in a good way. And so I've done a lot of speaking about the topic, but I finally decided that I wanted to sit down and write the book and try to capture some of the things I've learned over the years, not just through breast cancer, but through, you know, really shifting my path into focusing on work that I'm passionate about, that I care about, and that makes a difference. And so when I sat down to write the book, I realized that several other women's stories kept coming up in my head, people I had met throughout the years. Some of them found their lumps through our campaign, and I've kept in touch with them since then. And so I decided to not just write about my story, but to highlight other women's stories as well, because like me, they all have gone through breast cancer and then made some major shift in their life, something that has created a major life change, focused on giving back, focused on using the gifts that they have and, you know, putting it into, you know, something that they're really passionate about. And I find their stories to be super inspiring. And so the book really highlights, you know, all of those stories together.
And the book is laid out in a unique way. Each chapter follows in chronological order, finding the lump, the diagnose, making the announcement that you have breast cancer, having down days, meeting milestones. And it's your story in, you know, those milestone events, and then the five other women that you talked about. If a person could read only one of those chapters. Now, we want them to read them all because it's a complete story. But which one do you think is the most important?
Well, you know, I think that they're all important, obviously. But, I wrote the book in that way so that somebody could choose to read it start to finish, or they could pick it up and go directly to the section that they're in. You know, if they're going through their own treatment, it's easy to find the section that you might be, you know, traveling on that same path as well. I think the final chapters are really inspiring to me, even when I still read them, you know, about finding your voice. So it basically summarizes how, you know, each of us traveled on this path, and our paths were different, even though it sounds so similar. We all found our lump at a young age, got diagnosed with breast cancer, but everybody's story is a little different. But the commonality that came out of it, you know, the fact that each of these women somehow found their voice through this journey and then went on to say something big with their voice. I think those two chapters at the end are the ones that have a lot of takeaways that are good for anybody, not just someone who's going through breast cancer, but anybody who's experienced some sort of, you know, life change or hardship where you're really trying to make sense of it. I think those chapters are a good read.
Is the book aimed at those who have been diagnosed with breast cancer?
Well, certainly the book is about breast cancer. You know, each of us have been diagnosed with breast cancer, all the women in the book. I think that the general lessons, though, each chapter summarizes some key lessons about each stage of the breast cancer journey. And then, of course, at the end, as I mentioned, there are some takeaways around, you know, finding your voice. And so while it is sort of embedded in the breast cancer journey, that those takeaways can be used by anybody. I think it's also a good resource for someone who is supporting somebody going through breast cancer. It gives you an insight into how different women dealt with their path, and it can be helpful in learning how to support somebody who's going through breast cancer. So, yes, it is about breast cancer, but I do think the general lessons that are woven through it are applicable to anybody.
What was the most difficult part of your breast cancer journey and then writing about it?
You know, it was oddly, it did bring back a lot of emotion. I talk about my breast cancer journey a lot. So, you know, in some ways you might think it becomes a little numb to me. But in sitting down and writing about it and kind of revisiting those different parts, a couple things. I think remembering having to tell my parents and my brother. I found out over the phone. I was by myself in my house. And I remember thinking, I'm the only person that knows this right now, and I have a choice about how I share this information out into the world. And that always sort of chokes me up when I think about the day, you know, choosing to get in my car and knowing that I was going to my parents' house to tell them the news. And, you know, it kind of takes you back a little bit. And then the other part is, you know, I talk about mental health part of it a lot. I did really well through treatment. I didn't get sick. I felt mentally healthy. But coming out of breast cancer, when I was trying to get back to, you know, my normal life, if you will, I felt really broken and I felt very depressed. And I didn't really know that I was depressed. I think I just felt like, well, you just went through something really hard. Of course, you feel, you know, down. But I don't think I realized how bad it was until I finally decided to, I took 3 months off of work, went through weekly counseling and really spent some time, you know, unpacking what had happened to me and why I was struggling with getting back to normal. And so I talk about that a lot because I think it's one of those parts of the breast cancer journey that's not really the, you know, I guess it is medical at some level, but, you know, how people deal with it in an emotional, way, that always reminds me of how hard that time in my life was and how hard I worked to kind of put the pieces back together.
So, you know, I found that interesting in reading the book that getting the diagnosis itself, I mean, obviously it's a big shock. It's a big scare. There's a lot of fear there. But I also got the sense of just what you were talking about, having to tell your parents, having to tell the world, it affected you even more than getting the diagnosis. Would you say that's correct?
Yeah, I mean, yes, because when people hear cancer, they just think about you dying. And of course, you know, you're thinking about that too. Like, that's what crossed my mind when I heard that I had breast cancer. But once you start to reconcile it and realize that it's early stage and, you know, you have the facts, so in your head you know this is serious, but it is a good scenario. When you tell other people and you see the looks on their face, or you don't have hair and so you can't even keep it a secret anymore, you know, you're bald, you know what they're thinking. And so you almost have to retell yourself, I'm going to be okay. This is early stage. I'm going to get through this. And it's a really difficult thing to live through, just trying to give yourself a pep talk to remind yourself that you are going to be okay. And then with young women, of course, there's so many other issues that are playing in the background, you know, your fertility, whether or not you can have kids. I wasn't married at the time. So even though you're kind of in the forefront is this breast cancer, you know, illness that you're going through, but in the background are all these other really serious topics too that you can't really do anything about in the moment, but they're kind of playing in the background and weighing heavily on your brain, not really knowing what your life's going to look like, and that, you know, it's going to look different than you might have thought it was going to look. It's a really heavy weight sometimes.
So, Lee, we're almost out of time. I want to thank you very much for being with us today. What do you want readers to take away from the book?
I think I want them to have a sense of inspiration that, you know, you really, the three things I saw through all of the women, the sort of threads that I noticed each woman had, were that they really made a choice about how they framed their situation. And they chose a frame that did not look backwards. It looked forward. And so they may have had down days. They may have had struggles. But they made a conscious choice to focus on the future. And then each of them found a passion. And they made time and space in their life to spend time doing that passion. They stripped things out that got in the way of being able to spend time doing those things. And so I think, you know, having these things that these topics that you see cut through all of these women, they really give you a way to think about your life and to focus on what kind of path you want and how you can say something big. It doesn't have to be starting a foundation. It can be simple choices that you make every day that make make a change that puts your life on a better path.
The book is Say Something Big, Stories About Little Lumps Inspiring Big Changes. Lee Hurst, the founder of Feel Your Boobies Foundation. Hey, Lee, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Scott. Appreciate it.
Tomorrow is the election day. Stay tuned to WYTF throughout the day today and tomorrow for all the updates that will keep you up to date on what's going on in Pennsylvania around the country.
For a deeper look at the changing tide of healthcare, check out WITF's Transforming Health at transforminghealth.org, a partnership of WITF, WellSpan Health, and Capital Blue Cross.